From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The Reverend William Sloan Coffin died earlier this week after a life of activism that included the civil rights and anti-war movements. Coffin was the chaplain at Yale University for 18 years before heading the influential Riverside Church in Manhattan. On today's Fresh Air, we'll listen back to a 1985 interview with him. Also, some great buoyant piano playing. We hear an excerpt of our concert with the jazz pianist Dave Burrell. You can hear the influence of Jelly Roll Morton and stride pianists in his performance. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the notorious Betty Page about the 1950s pinup star. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Reverend William Sloan Coffin, the activist minister who became famous and infamous for speaking out against the Vietnam War, died Wednesday of congestive heart failure. He was 81. Coffin, an ordained Presbyterian minister, served in World War II and worked briefly for the CIA, then spent 18 years as the chaplain at Yale University, a term that included all of the conflict-filled 1960s. That's when he became internationally known for his activism in the civil rights and peace movements. He led many protests against the Vietnam War and stood up against the administrations of both Yale and the White House. Doonesbury cartoonist Gary Trudeau's character of Reverend Scott Sloan was partially based on Coffin, whom Trudeau knew as a student at Yale. In later years, the real Reverend opposed the 1991 war in the Persian Gulf and the invasion of Iraq in 2003. His most recent book, published last year, is titled Letter to a Young Doubter. Terry spoke with William Sloan Coffin in 1985. She asked him why, after serving in World War II and working briefly with the CIA, he was drawn to the religious life.
Well, I think the main thing is to have the religious questions. And World War II certainly raised some very deep questions about the inhumanity of human beings to other human beings, seeing what the Nazis did to the Jews, and also seeing men fall on grenades there was no time to throw back. So when I went to college afterwards, I knew what the important questions were, and the people who wrestled with them were either good atheists, like Sartre and Camus in France at that time, or deeply religious people like Niebuhr's and Paul Tillich, people like that.
You were very active in the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War, and you've written that you were disturbed that the New Left was a largely agnostic movement. What concerned you about that, and what struck you as being agnostic about it?
Well, it was not only that they didn't believe in God. That never bothers me quite so much, because I think the really important question is, in whom does God believe? And I think God believes in a lot of people who say they don't believe in God. If faith is being grasped by the power of love, then there are obviously a lot of people responding to God, even though they may not say, I believe in God. So it wasn't agnostic so much in the sense that people didn't believe in God. But there's a lot of bitterness. Lord Acton once said, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power absolutely. He could have gone on to say, and by the way, powerlessness also corrupts, and absolute powerlessness absolutely. That is, people who are opposing the government and feel they're getting no place tend toward bitterness, tend toward hatred. They fight national righteousness with personal self-righteousness, and they become, well, let me put it this way. It seems to me that if you love the good, you have to hate evil, or you're sentimental. But if you hate evil more than you love the good, you end up a damn good hater. And unfortunately, in the peace movement, there are good haters. I'm not saying the majority by any matter of means, and I certainly understand how people become embittered and get that way, but it's always sad to see that happen.
Where did you draw the line yourself as far as tactics? Because there were, especially on college campuses, there were many students who were taking over buildings and trashing certain records, even destroying certain buildings that were funded by the Defense Department doing war-related research. So what were your moral lines then about what you thought was an appropriate action to try to stop the war?
Well, my question would always be, is this going to stop the war? Is this going to be effective? Are you doing this to make yourself feel better? Or are you doing this to improve the situation? One has to avoid the politics of self-indulgence, self-pity, which isn't always easy when you get in these situations. On the violent side, you don't have to condone it, but you cannot condemn it without pointing at what produced it. And the important thing is always to try to focus people's attention on the causes of this, which, again, was very hard during the war in Vietnam, that it was the war that was causing this. Actually, in the United States, there was very, very little violence in reaction to the violence in Vietnam. It was the movement was pretty nonviolent.
We're listening to Terry's interview with William Sloan Coffin, who died on Wednesday. They spoke in 1985, when there was a growing Christian presence in political and social issues, led by such religious figures as Billy Graham and Jerry Falwell. 3 years after this interview, in 1988, evangelical leader Pat Robertson would make a bid for the White House, and soon afterward found the Christian Coalition. Let's return to Terry's interview with William Sloan Coffin.
Do you think that there's a religious resurgence now?
Yes, but it's not a religious resurgence isn't always a good thing. That may sound like a funny thing for a reverend to say, but it's like there are no atheists in foxholes. If that means that you're living at a profound level because you're in a foxhole, or because you're experiencing the fragility of human life, that's a good thing. But if it simply means you're suspicious as hell and you better start believing in order to save your life, then that's not good. And if a lot of people are going back to church to save their souls, not to transcend themselves, then it's not necessarily a good thing. And if they're coming back because we live in an age of enormous uncertainty and they want simple certainties of the kind that fundamentalists are apt to give, then I can't say that that's necessarily a good thing. My view of the faith is it should make it possible for you to live with uncertainty. It shouldn't provide certainty. It should make it possible for you, because a mighty fortress is your God, to live with temporal insecurity of every kind.
You've written that you see this conflict going on now between authoritarian and humanitarian Christianity. Would you explain that?
Well, there are those, I think, who turn to religion, and this isn't only Christianity, who are looking basically for law and order. And they tend to see religion in terms of rules and regulations, in terms of dogma. My feeling is that, as St. Augustine once said, love God and do what you like, which is not license, but freedom. It's a little, rules and regulations are a little bit like the stick that holds up the tomato vine. Without the stick, the vine couldn't get off the ground. But it's a combination of sun and soil that strengthens, nourishes the tomato vine. And there's no life coming out of that stick. And I think it's the same way with rules and regulations. They are penultimate. They're not ultimate. They point beyond themselves. Don't look at us. Use us to get beyond ourselves. And that the integrity of love is much more important than the purity of dogma. So to me, a true believer is one whose heart is overflowing with compassion and love for others, and who feels that rules and regulations are important but not ultimately important. And one other thing I'd say is you'll find that people who are really law and order Christians are more impressed with God's power than they are with God's love.
Do you feel like the fundamentalists who preach a more rule and regulation-oriented religion are, in a sense, your opponents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they differ. It's a different interpretation. I mean, if they think this is it, the Bible says this, or the Quran says this, fundamentalists who just find all the answers, you know, and simple certainties of this kind, you can't say that you believe life should be conducted in that fashion either. I mean, the cruelty that fundamentalists, as a rule, show to homosexuals is, to me, quite abhorrent. I also think they're very ignorant. I know the Bible as well as they do, and I've done as much scholarship on what these passages mean, and I know perfectly well that the Bible as a whole is certainly not pro-homosexuality, no question about that. But it never deals with long-term loving relationships between people of the same sex, for instance. That's not in the Bible. Now, when patently you see examples of that before you, and you know people who are enjoying that kind of relationship, you have to ask, well, what's going on here? Maybe there's more to be learned than what's found in one or two biblical passages. So in that sense, I guess we are opponents.
Reverend William Sloan Coffin speaking to Terry Gross in 1985. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's get back to Terry's 1985 interview with the Reverend William Sloan Coffin. He died Wednesday at age 81.
You have presided over, I'm sure, many, many, many ceremonies, weddings and and funerals and births and so on and so on. Those are times when people tend to really turn towards their religion, I think, those periods of ceremony or periods of loss. Is that an important time for you as a minister in that respect, because people are maybe more open at points like that in their lives?
This may surprise you or some of your listeners, but I would much rather not be known for being a social activist, as the happiest moments in my life are not in that area. They're much more in the intimate settings. They're moments when you're doing marriage counseling or when you're comforting people who have suffered loss, because those are the moments when human beings tend to be most human. People, when they're about to get married or are deeply in love, they're in a position to understand that our value is finally a gift and not an achievement, that love doesn't seek value but creates it. The expression's walking on air, a terrific expression. You don't climb up on air, you're levitated there by somebody else's love, right? Or I'm on cloud nine. It's a terrific expression, you know, because you didn't make it on your own. Grace did. Somebody else's love. Somebody did for you what you couldn't do for yourself. So those are wonderful moments for people to appreciate these most profound truths about life. And the same thing is true when you're suffering loss. I lost my own son 2 years ago in a terrible accident. But since then, I've been in a position to help people who have lost their own children, as I wasn't before. I know exactly what they're going through. I know the feeling the world has nothing to give like that which it takes away. I know the anger and resentment they feel, the unfairness, you know. And I can stick with it. I don't protest it, you know. I says, go ahead, you know, fight it. Tears are absolutely important and all the rest of it. And then people gradually work their way out of their grief. They begin to realize, well, grief isn't perhaps the best way to hold this person close. And so you're with people when they are most vulnerable, and that's always the most satisfying part of the ministry. Baptism would be a little bit the same way. If they're being personally baptized, it'd be very much the same way. And if they're baptizing a child, it's a very important moment.
After a loss, after the death of someone close to you, so many people, I think, go through either feeling that the religion has been renewed because they're relying so much on the religion, but on the other hand, a lot of people turn away from it and think that, you know, that any sense of God that they had was shattered by the unfairness of this terrible loss that they've suffered. And I mean, how can you console?
Well, first of all, people have some very goofy ideas about how the will of God operates. I can remember when our boys in Lebanon were blown up, you remember, in that terrible accident, 269, was it? And on television, night after night, for about a week, I guess, mothers and wives were pictured, and through their tears, many of them said, well, I guess it was the will of God. As if it was God's will that anybody be shot in this world, as if it's the will of God that anybody blow up anybody in this world, you know? It is never, people seem to think God goes around the world with his finger on triggers, his hands on steering wheels, with knives, his fists around knives, you know? So they always say, how did God let it happen? Well, my son was behind the wheel. God wasn't behind the wheel. My consolation came in feeling that the moment the waves came over Alex's car, God's heart was the first of all our hearts to break. That's what gave me comfort. I knew God was heartbroken over this dumb, stupid, tragic accident. And that's the way God feels about every loss in this world. Now, there are some mysterious things, such as cancer, that we still don't understand, you know, or worse yet, retarded children, you know, that's nobody's fault. Those are things we don't know much about. But if we don't know, then let's not pretend we do. And it's better to trust where you can't understand. And never forget all the unmerited good there is in this world. I mean, what did you and I ever do to enjoy a day like the day outside today? It is sensational. Sensational. I didn't earn it. So when we have unmerited evil, let's constantly remember the unmerited good. But I think for Christians to understand that you can always take your wounds to the wounded Lord and know that Christ will understand you, God will understand you, Jews have the same understanding of this, then you find legitimate comfort. Legitimate comfort. God is not in the event. God is in the response to the event.
Do you think that by saying, well, God must have wanted it if these boys were killed or whatever it is to, in a way, relieve yourself of responsibility for your own actions?
Well, sometimes, though I don't think, when it came to Marines being killed over there, you can't hold the parents responsible for the fact that a dumb decision was made to expose them that way by moving out of neutrality and taking part in the intervention in Lebanon. But I think the basic understanding that is hard for people is that we really do have free will. And free will, you have to have freedom if love is going to be the name of the game. And if we're free, then we're free to do bad as well as free to do good things. Free to be selfish, free to be generous. And to blame God for what people do with their freedom is not fair, except in the same way that you might say to a child, if you saw a child smash an expensive watch, it was your fault for giving the kid the watch in the first place. Now, you can blame God for giving us human freedom. Maybe we are not ready for it. We can't handle it. But it seems to me that's about where the blame stops.
You've done a lot of marriages. What do you think of interfaith marriage between Catholics and Protestants or Christians and Jews?
I think that it can work in two instances. If their religion doesn't mean anything to them, it won't get in their way. And if it means everything to them, their religious roots will produce enough branches so that the branches will intertwine wonderfully. I think I mentioned Rabbi Heschel. He was a really profound Jew. I adored that man. He was my mentor. It never would have occurred to me to want to convert him any more than it would have occurred to him to convert me. My mother wasn't Jewish. But both of us had very profound roots, religious roots, Christian and Jewish, so that the branches that came forth in those roots just reached out to each other, and intertwined in the most wonderful fashion. So if both people are profoundly religious, then I think it does work. The trouble comes when one of them, let's say, is very religious and the other isn't, and here comes Sunday morning, and let's say he wants to read the New York Times and stay home and enjoy a nice morning. And she said, no, I want to go to church, And then the friction begins. How are the children going to be brought up? And then you use religion in a way it shouldn't be used because the real problem is between you and that sort of thing. But basically, I think we can handle interfaith. The main thing in marriage is that people share that which means most to them and have an enormous amount of respect for each other. Now, if respect can be maintained and a capacity to share what means most, then you have a pretty good marriage, I think.
A lot of people are very obsessed with success now and with goal orientation and achieving their 5-year plan and everything. And I wonder if you've ever been overtaken by that in any way within the world of the church, and how you've dealt with your own sense of what you want to accomplish and what is success going to mean in the terms that you're going to define it for yourself.
I've had lots of problems in my life and lots of battles, but that's never been much of one. I was always pretty clear, I think, that justice and peace and things like that were areas where I felt a strong stand had to be taken. I do remember when I was at Yale, at one point in 1968, I was apparently the leading candidate to go to Riverside. And the head of the search committee came up to Yale to see me and told me so. And I knew that 2 weeks down the line, I would be accepting draft cards in the Arlington Street Church in Boston. And then a few days later, be turning them into the Justice Department in Washington, for which I would, in all likelihood, get arrested, which is what happened. Spock and I and some others were arrested. And I did, for just the briefest of moments, stop to think that, gee, if I go ahead on these draft cards, they'll never invite me to Riverside. But it was the briefest of moments, I'm glad to report, because then it just came through very clearly to me. You do not conduct yourself in your present job according to your wishes for your future job. And so it ended just like that. And sure enough, they didn't invite me to Riverside, at least not for another 9 years. But that's never been, I guess, first of all, I guess it's pride, too. I mean, I have an image of myself, and I just couldn't bear to be. If I would have had an image of myself as somebody who sold out, somebody who could be bought, yeah, I just couldn't live with it. Secondly, I can't bear to be bored, and I think a lot of the people who live safe, sterile lives are bored to death. Who was it who said, if you do not share, Oliver Wendell Holmes, if you do not share in the action and passion of your times, you must count yourself as not having lived, something like that. And I think he was right. You know, it's my life at least has not been boring.
The Reverend William Sloan Coffin, speaking to Terry Gross in 1985. He died Wednesday at age 81. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. From GM, working to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions with vehicles that run on gasoline or E85 ethanol. Details at livegreengoyellow.com. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Often while his left hand plays boogie-woogie or classical blues, his right hand expresses new sounds with great effects. That's a description of jazz pianist and composer Dave Burrell. Coming up, we listen back to an excerpt of our concert with Dave Burrell. And film critic David Edelstein reviews The Notorious Betty Page. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. As we wind up the week, today we present an encore performance of a concert recorded last year in the Fresh Air studio. I'll let Terry do the introductions.
The last time I heard pianist and composer Dave Burrell perform solo, all I could think of was, we have to get him to play on our show. In the late 60s, Burrell was one of the mavericks of the jazz avant-garde. He's recorded with Archie Shepp and Pharoah Sanders. But he also loves early jazz styles. As our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has said, Burrell mixes the antique and the modern with a naturalness recalling Earl Hines, Monk, and Sun Ra. Like them, he evokes more than recreates early jazz styles. Burrell combines an avant-garde pianist's love of density with a buoyant old-timey sense of rhythm. Gary Giddens has called Burrell a scintillating solo performer. Thurston Moore of the band Sonic Youth put Burrell's album Echoes in the number one slot on his list of the top 10 free jazz underground recordings. Dave Burrell grew up in Middletown, Ohio, Harlem, and Hawaii. When his family moved to Hawaii after World War II, they were among the few African-American families there. Burrell's latest CD is called Expansion, and it features his group, The Full-Blown Trio, drummer Andrew Cyril and bass player William Parker. Dave Burrell, welcome to Fresh Air. This is something I've been wanting to do for a long time, so
thanks.
Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And there's a song that's on your new CD that I'd love you to start with. I've also heard you perform it in concert. It's a real treat. This is your reworking of the Irving Berlin song, They Say That Falling in Love is Wonderful. Would you do it for us?
Sure.
Wonderful. I love the way you do that. No, one of the things I just particularly love about your playing is that some of it's really rooted in the very early days of jazz. Ragtime, Jelly Roll Morton. At the same time, you've played a lot of free jazz. You're an avant-gardist. And the two kind of come together and meet in the middle in your playing. You're drawing on both ends, plus on the whole kind of history of American popular song. And I love the way you've kind of fallen in love with both historical ends and incorporated it for your own means.
Right. Thanks. I didn't really start off for it to be that way. I think that I was caught up in the avant-garde or free jazz movement in the mid-60s in New York, and I was still working on becoming a firmly rooted traditionalist. The players around me that I really respected were interested in both as well. John Coltrane was just departing from tradition and had really validated for all of us colleagues that it was okay if you had a firm tradition. a solid foundation that you could go ahead and explore other ways of hearing, other ways of soloing, painting.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to play a Jelly Roll Morton composition for us now, and this is The Crave. Do you want to say anything about it before you play it?
Yes, The Crave is one of the most significant of all of his rags because it has the Spanish tinge, which is boom, 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 boom. And that ingredient at the time, Morton, when I heard him talk to Alan Lomax at the Smithsonian, he said to Lomax that that ingredient was very necessary part of the jazz of his era to be included.
So this is Dave Burrell at the piano playing Jelly Roll Morton's The Crave. Dave Burrell playing Jelly Roll Morton's The Crave. You had already played a lot of free jazz and avant-garde jazz before playing Jelly Roll Morton. Were there things in the Morton compositions that struck you as being almost avant-garde in some way? Do you know what I mean? Of being much more modern than you would have thought they could have been in the 1920s.
Yes, yes. Bass lines that are so very syncopated that they're timeless, and it doesn't matter what you attach them to. You could have a Morton-inspired bass line at this release point, for example, on The Crave. That note at the end is just sort of shoved into the ensemble of notes as an intrusive pedal point sound, which has just sort of been mimicked throughout the decades.
Dave Burrell, visiting Terry Gross in the Fresh Air Studios for a concert and conversation last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
¶¶
Let's get back to jazz pianist Dave Burrell and his 2005 Fresh Air concert and conversation with Terry Gross.
When you were playing full free jazz, I mean, you came to New York in the 60s?
65.
And you were playing free jazz. You were playing with people like Ornette Coleman, Marion Brown, Pharoah Sanders. And was it hard to find a place for yourself in free jazz as a pianist? Sure, there's Cecil Taylor, but Ornette Coleman, for instance, didn't have a piano in his group. And I think a lot of free jazz players might have felt that, you know, piano just harmonically didn't belong.
That's correct. That's what most everybody said. And the piano players had to figure out how to not disturb this new trend. And so what I started doing was learning the melodies, and I'd play along with the horns. And I wouldn't play any chords. And so I became a horn myself. And if it was a short, snappy head like, then I was out and the horn went on to solo with the bass and drum. And then later on, the horn soloists, frontline people, would turn around to me, and they didn't want chords. They wanted color and rhythm from me. So I had to play clusters that sounded in the idiom of where the melody and the solo, where it had come to, with something like a cluster like what I just played, wouldn't disturb it. So maybe the horn player is up here. And I just went. So that was working sometimes. I think that the most difficult part was the horn players were just figuring out how to become very energetic and not play within some box or some framework. So you can imagine someone just taking a motif and arguing the motif as vigorously as they chose, and the pianist going. The drums and the rhythm section are all doing a chant that stays the same. The horns, however, are leaving the immediate premise.
At the same time that you were, you know, playing all this free jazz in concert, would you go home and then try to learn like Scott Joplin rags? Because that has been such a fundamental part of who you are.
Yes, in the back of our minds, most of the innovators knew what Coltrane had done, and I think that he was the leader of being able to say, well, I departed after I thoroughly explored the so-called inside, and I wrote Giant Steps, and I feel now that I must move on to not only into atonal music, but to modes and other approaches. And I have my credentials in order. That's Mr. Coltrane talking, and I think everybody else in the jazz community would agree.
Now, I think, tell me if this is right, that John Coltrane's Giant Steps is based on an exercise?
Yeah, it is based on a chord progression that has been taken after its initial. That chord progression has a linkage that takes it to an identical chord progression in another key. It's something that he put together. He got a motif probably from a book like Nicholas Lanevsky's. You could call it an etude, like a Chopin etude, to get better in scurrying around different chord changes for him personally.
Now, Giant Steps, a lot of horn players have played that, and mm-hmm. it's, I think, usually a horn musician's, you know, tune. You do it on piano. You have like a stride piano version of Giant Steps.
Mm-hmm.
Would you play it for us?
Sure.
And this is Dave Burrell at the piano. Listen to you play, I think how strong your fingers are.
Well, a lot of the avant-garde pianists, from having to keep up with drummers that were so strong, like Elvin Jones and Andrew Surreal, even Philly Joe, not to mention Max Roach, but in order to say be there in and be heard and be in the mix, you found that you played a lot harder than you thought you could. And oftentimes, when the ensemble was finished and they had played for an hour, they would want a piano solo. So you would have to keep playing.
Dave Burrell, it's just been great talking with you and hearing you play. I'm so glad we did this. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jazz pianist Dave Burrell recorded last year. His CD Expansion is on the Hi2 label. Burrell is working on a number of upcoming projects, including a CD to be released in June called Consequences. It's with drummer Billy Martin of the group Badeski, Martin, and Wood. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Notorious Betty Page. This is Fresh Air. The new movie, The Notorious Betty Page, explores the life of the 1950s pinup queen. Betty Page posed for under-the-counter men's fetish magazines and for photos and films for private collectors into bondage. Her pictures became part of a 1955 Senate investigation into the impact of pornography on youth. The Notorious Betty Page was directed by Mary Harron and stars Gretchen Mol as Betty. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The notorious Betty Page is the most wholesome portrait of a bondage magazine queen you'll ever see, and Gretchen Mol in the title role has a glow that's downright healthy. For the first part of the film, Betty's body gives her little pleasure. As a girl, she marches grimly up to the bedroom with her father after church. Her marriage to a high school football star ends in physical abuse. A folksy bumpkin stops her on the street and asks her to a dance, and the gang rape that follows in a building on the outskirts of town is bearable only because the movie cuts away from it. It's only in the 1950s, when Betty moves to New York and becomes a girly mag pinup sensation and goes on to vinyl boots and then whips and ropes, that all traces of serious perversion waft away. You don't have to be an anti-porn feminist like the late Andrea Dworkin to be troubled by the movie's total separation of bondage from male aggression. But the filmmakers have good feminist pedigrees. In addition to I Shot Andy Warhol, director Mary Harron made the ultimate satire of male aggression, the surprisingly unsensationalized adaptation of Bret Easton Ellis's American Psycho. Her co-writer, Guinevere Turner, starred in and co-wrote the indie hit Go Fish. Their affection for Betty Page confirms my sense that just as many women as men are Page devotees. Women I know respond to Page's innocent delight and to the palpable lack of threat in how she's displayed. It's S&M role-playing as clean, dirty fun. There's a surrogate family aspect to Harron's depiction of the nudie cutie world. Betty is well looked after by pornmeister Irving Claw, and especially his half-sister Paula, who's played with Jewish mother spunkiness by the wonderful Lily Taylor.
Whoa. Anyone walks in these old shoes is beyond me.
Come here, Father Go.
Hey, Jack, give her a hand.
Oh, hello.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
These shoes are kind of unusual.
We've got a lot of requests for them, don't we, Irving?
Sure do. 8-inch stiletto heels, black seam stockings, 12 different poses. High heels are very popular.
There you go. Okay, sit it down there, Jack. All right, Betty. Let's go.
Beautiful, Betty.
Oh, I think we've got a little problem. Something's peeking out.
Oh, yep. We better put another pair over them. Yeah, we got to put these over the ones you got on. These will be okay, huh? Yeah, bro, as if the customers care. It's the shoes they want.
Shoes and boots and shoes. I can't get enough of them.
Why?
Don't ask. Takes all types to make a world.
What kind of types?
You see, the customers who want this stuff, they're very respectable, very high-quality people. Doctors, lawyers, diplomats, even a judge. They're not people like us. The pressures they've got, they're not your average Joe. So what if they want something that seems a little strange, right? If it makes them happy,
sure.
The notorious Betty Page has tongue-in-cheek brassy music and lurid black-and-white cinematography, but it doesn't tip over into camp. And even though Harron bounces blithely along the surface of her subject, there's a hint of something deeper, that Betty goes in for stylized S&M because of how she was sexually damaged. In method acting class, she seems incapable of psychological self-plumbing. She'd rather be a clown and doff her clothes. It's long past time for a backlash to the Gretchen Mol backlash. 8 years after Vanity Fair editors put her on their cover as the next It Girl, and then when her movies bombed, let it be known they were duped by her publicists. Guess what? She should have been the next It Girl. She's a terrific actress. Here, with her blue-black hair, she looks so much like Paige that this could be a documentary. And her swings back and forth between modesty and exhibitionism are amazingly fluid. When Betty models in front of a posse of photographers and someone yells, "Show us your keister," she's taken aback for an instant. And then she flashes a naughty grin and plants her rump in the air. The clicking of cameras sounds like happy animals munching. But the mood isn't predatory. It's Betty who's eating it up. The mid-50s Kefauver anti-porn congressional hearings that for a time shut down the industry end her career. But when she's born again, she doesn't reject her past. Her fundamentalist Christianity is just another stage in her evolution. Once she posed nude in nature. Now she preaches the gospel in nature to anyone who'll listen, in a park. She's still just doing what comes naturally. Over the end credits, Mol does a charming dance that's so free-spirited, the angels wouldn't know whether to sing or to Wolf Whistle.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. From the Everett Foundation, working with the nonprofit Medicare Rights Center in support of Medicare for All, online at medicarerights.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Former Washington Post journalist Pete Early has written a new memoir about his struggle to have his bipolar son properly diagnosed and treated. In his book, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness, he writes that jails have become warehouses for the mad. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pete Early. Join us for the next Fresh Air.